Media shouldn't be one note. Support Rabble.ca and a diversity of voices in Canadian media. Visit rabble.ca/donate to contribute.
This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared creates collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face. My interview today was an absolute delight. It was with Susan Delacourt, and we talked a great deal about her new book called Shopping for Votes. The subtitle of the book is How Politicians Choose Us and We Choose Them. She's a political columnist with the Toronto Star and iPolitics. She's been working on these issues and as a journalist since the 80s. We talk a lot about the media. We talked a lot about Stephen Harper and Prime Minister Trudeau. We talked about one of the lines was how Harper was talking about dollars, but Trudeau was talking about change. That was a quote from Susan. I think we even get a Annie Hall reference into this interview, which is a lot of fun. But there's something really hopeful and wonderful about Susan's book, but about her as well, and about her approach. And so I think you're going to really enjoy this interview for a variety of reasons. If you care about where we're heading as a country, if you care about politics, and also there's a couple of great stories that Susan has to tell, and about how they had an influence on her writing and on this book. And so stay tuned for more with Susan Delacourt. Check out davidpecklive.com for more podcasts if you'd like to hire me as a speaker, or check out also my book, Real Change is Incremental. You can get it there. Susan Delacourt. Well, welcome to Face to Face, and we're joined today by another very special guest, a journalist, an author who has written a book called Shopping for Votes, subtitled How Politicians Choose Us and We Choose Them. Susan Delacourt is our guest today. Susan, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And from what I understand, you're still writing with the Toronto Star and iPolitics. You're a political columnist, author. You've written several books, award winner, too.
Award finalist, yes. The book made the finals for the Hillary Weston Award, and yes, I've received a couple of sort of career-long ones.
Nice. And probably well-deserved would be my guess.
I couldn't possibly say that.
Right. But we'll see if we can find somebody who will. Here's what Peter Mansbridge says about your new book, Shopping for Votes. Quote, "This may well be one of the most important and revealing books about Canadian politics written in some time. Delacourt does what Delacourt does best, breaks down the mystery and leaves you saying, now I get it. If you've ever wondered why political parties do what they do when they shop for your vote, the answers are on every page." Close quote. What a delightful quote. So how much did you have
I'm
to pay for that?
Peter back for that for a long time.
That's right. That's right. There's going to be dinner parties galore coming.
That's right. I promise I gave him no money for that.
Yes.
Reads like an ad.
Maybe a $50 chapters card is about
maybe
all.
Maybe that would be nice.
Something like that. So, well, I've almost finished the book, and I have to say congratulations, and what a delight to read. It reads like a journalistic piece, but it's academic, it's important, it's got so much detail, but also reads really well in a fun and a friendly sense as well. So, yeah. A terrific read. I thought I chose my political party.
No.
You're...
Well, yes, you do, to an extent.
Yeah.
But I think the great irony of politics right now, or at least for the last few decades, is the less interested we've become, or citizens have become, in politics, the more interested they've become in us.
Mm.
They've had to work a lot harder. You know, gone are the days when a politician could casually wander up to a voter's doorstep and get to know the person inside. People don't answer their doors. They don't answer their phones. the polls are usually wrong. So what the politicians have said, as you know, as you've read, is that the people who are very good at knowing who their consumers are is the marketing world. So they've been borrowing tips and techniques from marketing for, you know, over half a century. As the consumer world grew and marketers got to know their buyers better, the political people started borrowing the tips and techniques.
Like, I mean, on one level, it makes perfect sense, mm-hmm. right? Why wouldn't they do that? Right.
Yep.
I mean, it's a new medium. It's a new way of communicating. It's a new way of connecting with your constituents, et cetera, et cetera. But all of that sounds very sort of anti-relational in a sense. But if people aren't opening their doors, they've got to do something. But there's a sense in which, I mean, I don't want to go too cynical, but you sort of read the book and say, wow, really? This is how they're approaching us? Like, it's almost as if there's a dumbing down going on that, frankly, I find kind of alarming.
Well, that's what made me write the book.
Yeah.
Because I've worked in Ottawa for a long time, and I was noticing that the...
And is that what you got the medal for? Is that what you got the
award
for?
The light, yeah, it's just hanging in there.
That's right.
But the, you know, when I think I wrote this in the preface, but when I first came to Ottawa, I used to use metaphors to try to explain the relevance to people, and so... Sometimes Ottawa felt like a courtroom, you know.
Right.
Sometimes Ottawa felt a bit like a university lecture hall, especially during the Constitution. My degree is in politics, so I regarded it as sort of a, you know, an internship or a working education in what I'd learned in school. But I found the longer I was here, the less those metaphors were working. And it became clear to me that the language of the malls and the advertising world were more useful to people in trying to understand what people were doing. You know, that, and I think there's a real attempt to appeal to voters just through their wallets, that the only way that things were relevant to people was if it hit them in their pocketbook, which is, you know, those pocketbook issues. People don't say pocketbook in real life.
Right, right.
Pocketbook politics. So it occurred to me that it felt cynical. It felt a little transactional.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
And I'm not sure sort of allows people to be their best selves. But the phrase I kept using was, you know, we keep talking about value for the dollar, but we didn't talk about values or values of the heart and the mind.
Well, I've often wondered if governments are driven, you know, by the bottom line, certainly not necessarily by human rights or by, you know, relational principles, right? It's about the budget, it's about the line item and so on. And you know, because I'm a social change guy and because I want to think I can change the world and so my, you know, my students can as well, you want to be able to say things with a certain degree of hope. But if your government is just all about the bottom line, we're in deep trouble, aren't we?
Well, it's not just the government, though.
Right.
You know, the government just doesn't charge off in some direction willy-nilly. They're often doing this because they sense a demand. And I think the media, my own profession, has played a bit of a role in this. The problem is that values, plural, are very hard to quantify, and the media loves to quantify things. It loves to measure things. It loves to say that, you know, this is 10% more or 10% less.
Right.
And so I think that we certainly have enabled a dialogue in which politics is only about things that you can measure with numbers and preferably with dollar figures. So also, political parties need to raise money.
Yeah.
More so and more so now. And the successful parties, thanks to fundraising reforms, are the ones who raise little tiny bits of money. You know, like the tiny donations, you know, widespread donations. So in the sense that they operate as fundraising machines, too, of course they have lots to talk about with the marketing world.
So at what point do I just jump off the old Islington Bridge?
Please don't. please.
Yeah, that's the question. Because I go, you know, I want to talk about what's happening at a higher level. I also want to talk about grassroots. How do we meet in between? I mean, that's where change is going to occur. You know, the whole, you know, at the risk of sounding corny again, splash and ripple. That's the way things happen. So I want to talk about how our government is complicit to, you know, coming alongside cluster munitions, for instance. Right. Okay. So it's pretty nuanced and we're going in a little deeper and so on. And yet what you're kind of saying to me in shopping for votes is that actually you don't really, David. All you really want to talk about is how much money the government's going to save you because of child care or health care or wait times. It's all got to be quantifiable.
Here's where the 2015 election sort of plays with my thesis. And I think... I did this on The Current when they asked me to sum up Harper's legacy, and I said that
which
I
was, is kind of an unfair question in some regards.
Well, but it was such a fun way to do it. So, I did it with a cash register. Sound of a cash register.
Interesting. Okay.
The very first time that people started to think he could become prime minister was when he stood beside a cash register in an electronics store in the campaign of December 2005.
And in the town of Oakville, it was a town of Oakville, wasn't it, that he did that in?
I think it was...
Mississauga, something like
I think
that?
It might have been Mississauga.
West End of
Oakville,
Toronto, anyway.
Oakville was Tim Hortons.
Tim Hortons, that's right. The Tim Hortons in Oakville, yes.
And he was standing by a cash register there, too. But he stood by a cash register and announced that his government would lower the GST, never mind that it would bankrupt the Treasury.
Yes, that was a $12 to $14 billion kind of mistake, was it not?
Right. That's economists agree.
that's right.
So, but that was really, I that was the first bookend. And the final bookend was in the last week of the 2015 election campaign, he developed a little pattern, a routine on the stage, which he did with the Ford brothers.
Right.
Remember?
Yes,
to the
ping
sound of a cash register.
Yes.
And throwing money on the table, literally, to show how much a Liberal government would cost Canadians. And it didn't work. So I think the cash register sound and the noise and the image are a really good set of bookends to Stephen Harper's career, or maybe a decade in which that was a very powerful image. But I think the election gave me a little bit of hope, not because of the outcome, but because it revolved around Syrian refugees.
Right.
It revolved around the kneecap. We were actually having a discussion about Canadian values and foreign policy even in a Canadian election campaign, which told me that that's still out there, that people are not only voting with their wallets, people are not only looking for deep discounts on their taxes.
Right.
The winner promised to put the country into deficit, which says that people understand that there's more to life than seeing a discount on their taxes when they check out of the, you know, to the metaphorical cash register every year at tax time, that people are looking for a little bit more. So,
you know, I went to see Prime Minister Trudeau in Georgetown about a year and a half before I think he launched the campaign. And just because I was starting to, I don't know, I guess listen a little more closely and ended up leaving work early. And, you know, there was about 80 to 100 people there. And he was intimate. He handled Q&A well. He spoke well. He was in a hurry, so he didn't have a lot of time to chat. But I left encouraged from that meeting. And I remember coming home and talking to my wife about it, Elizabeth, and just saying, you know, there's a substance here that I don't think I've seen in a while. Now, you know, who knows where we're going to head and where things are going to go. So I, too, I think felt a little bit of that hope that I hope most other Canadians felt as well as they went to the polls. That stands out and above and beyond the cash register, you know?
Well, let me tell you the story about how Trudeau got an ever-increasing role in this book.
Are you allowed to call him Trudeau just because you're a journalist?
Well, I guess I should call him the Prime Minister. It wasn't Trudeau then, he was...
I always love those scenes in, like, the West Wing when somebody was, like, you know, trying to be disparaging toward the president and they'd refer to him as Bartlett, and then one of the guys would go, "That's President Bartlett."
That's right. I've asked the staff what they call him.
Oh, okay.
These are his old friends, you know,
yes,
in there, and they call him Prime Minister.
Oh, okay. Well, it kind of makes sense.
But whatever you want to call him, I'll tell you how he got in the book.
Good.
So there's a place, a restaurant in Ottawa called the Metropolitan, which is right in the center of the action. And in fact, as we're speaking today, it sits in front of where the sinkhole is in Ottawa.
Oh, okay.
But it's a much trafficked site. You know, you sit there and you see the world go by.
Right.
So in the initial writing of this book in 2012, Trudeau had not yet even declared whether he was going to be running for leader. We suspected he was getting interested in it. But I was sitting out on a terrace there on a nice summer day with a friend of mine explaining that I was at the part in the book where I was describing and realizing, learning, I guess, how bad the Liberals were at the marketing game. They were dreadfully behind the New Democrats and the Conservatives. They didn't seem to like the idea of marketing. And I was pointing with my hand in the direction of the convention center and saying, I watched them at that convention and they did not like this stuff. And into my hand, like that point in the Woody Allen movie where Marshall McLuhan shows up, Justin Trudeau walks up to my...
Oh, come on.
I'm not kidding. And he says, and I said to my friend, I said, well, here, he'll explain it. Why are you guys so bad at this? So he gave me a little speech about why Liberals took a different view of marketing, niche marketing, boutique tax credits, on the fly. And my friend, who had never been around Trudeau before either, was quite impressed. She said, I didn't know that he could do that.
Mm.
So I thought, I've got to get that in this book. So the first draft of the book, which for complicated reasons had to be rewritten again because of publisher problems a year later. Anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself. So that version, that little speech by Trudeau got into the first version of the book. My book went into bankruptcy protection, my publisher did, for about 6 months. And in the meantime, I traveled with Trudeau writing an e-book for the Toronto Star.
Well, neat. Okay.
So I spent a couple of months getting to know him and seeing him out in the road. And then so the next version of the book had even more of him in it. And he takes quite an interest in this subject. He's interested in advertising. So he got a bigger part. And, of course, the next time I went to rewrite it for the paperback edition, the one we're talking about now, he had to have the last two chapters because his views have evolved a bit on that, I think. They have really embraced some of the tools that their rivals used in data marketing and data collection. But their conviction is, and they would say this, of course, but I think they say it with some justification, is that they're using the tools for different reasons. That they actually do believe that you can use modern marketing tools to have a conversation about values in Canada and about what binds us together as a community.
Well, and I think, I mean, if you want to extend the analogy or the metaphor, you can use a screwdriver as a chisel. You can use it as a pry bar.
That's right.
I mean, I think it does come down to the questions that you take into it and some of the assumptions you make and so on. You know, it's really interesting. I find your book sort of this mix of sort of not cynicism's the wrong word. It's just a kind of a dose of reality. I mean, I love the quote by Gerald Butts at the beginning. At the beginning of the book in the introduction, the idea of being a consumer, quote, has become such a fundamental way of being that it's absorbed into who we are. Butts says you can lament it, you can applaud it, or you can celebrate it, or you can hate it. It is what it is. Mm-hmm. Never been a big fan of the phrase "it is what it is" because
yeah,
to me
either.
It's a great way of saying nothing, right?
Yeah.
It's just, you know, it's, oh, well, that's, you know, you might as well not fight it, folks. Let's absolve ourselves of any kind of moral sense of responsibility here. But the fact that I think anyone at that level is so willing to say, I'm a consumer, therefore, don't you find that a bit troubling?
I sure do.
Yeah, no,
yeah.
I figured you'd say so.
Yeah,
it bothers the heck out of me. I mean, nice Marshall McLuhan reference, too, but I think you'd probably agree.
Yeah, I'm still not sure I agree with Butts that he believes that the last election was fundamentally about pocketbook issues. I don't think it was. I don't think that was on everybody's mind. I think change was on people's mind.
Right.
To complete the cash register analogy I've used before, Harper was talking about dollars and Trudeau was talking about change.
Right. Nice.
So, but I, you know, they're the ones looking at the data every day. They seem to know what, or seem to think they know what was on people's minds. And they, maybe this is cynicism, maybe this is experience, I don't know. But the political pros seem to think that what moves votes is what people's concerns closest to home.
Right.
And that's why Trudeau went into a radio studio and taped 40 ads in one day.
Wow.
All with little local concerns put in them. Some
right.
of those concerns aren't little themselves, but particular local concerns. They were gathering up data to find out what was making people angry, what would make them vote, and then this all was plotted on a huge chart, and then ads designed for those particular communities concerned.
So do you, Susan, believe, like, alongside of Harper and Reagan, that the pictures were all that the viewers remembered, to quote Reagan in your book? You know, that's, you know, Reagan had a huge impact on Stephen Harper, apparently, and how he approached this.
It's interesting. Know. Ronald Reagan had an impact on Trudeau, too.
Mm.
He's some of their advertising, they were deliberately trying to channel the Morning in America
right.
Feeling that Ronald Reagan brought. No, I don't think I could be a journalist if I believed that was.
Well, I mean, and so I guess already here's your follow-up question, and you haven't even answered the question, and please take it wherever you want to go with it. But, you know, is a picture really worth 1,000 words? I mean, I've never bought that personally.
People do care about the pictures.
Yeah, yeah, no, for sure.
I think they do. And certainly they seem to like the pictures of Justin Trudeau.
True.
They are playing image politics far as well as Harper did.
Sure.
Harper paid a lot of attention to it, too. And these guys, the liberals, are playing it just as well. And I don't, you know, it's kind of a cheap answer, but I don't think they'd be doing it if it didn't work.
Right.
And the energy that all politicians devote to that image stuff is huge. That was a pretty neat, like, a pretty interesting advertising group. I spent a lot of time talking to Trudeau's advertising people to do this update. And they were taking some chances that were interesting, although I love that the same people who did the Joe, I am Canadian ad the early 2000s
yeah.
did all the ads for Trudeau this time,
it
too.
You
could
cracks
actually
me up.
See the similarities. You could hear the cadence.
Yeah, no, it's true. You know, my son and I were in our basement. TV was on. I can't remember what was happening. But it was a real quick kind of peripheral, almost catch of the screen, and there was Justin walking towards the screen, and Parliament in the background, a Steadicam shot, you know, wonderful shot of him. And he said, you know, Stephen Harper says I'm not ready for. I'll tell you what I'm ready for. And bam, 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 and it was like four or five things in a row. My son, 10 years old, says, Dad, he didn't say anything negative.
Mm-hmm.
And I was blown away.
Yeah.
Right? That a 10-year-old would have been perspicuous enough to see that, to make a note about it, to actually comment on it. And then you go, wow. And I hadn't really reflected on it until I read your book again. Wow, it really must have worked. But the fact that my son, it resonated, I'd like to think, my son doesn't care about the cash register, Susan, right?
No, and
you know?
Think that this is what, you know, Trudeau had some true believers there in the advertising, you know, who were
right.
very upset about Stephen Harper.
Right, right.
Those people at Ben Simon Byrne were, you know, they shared, they weren't just being paid.
They were in.
They had got religion on this.
Right, right. Drunk the Kool-Aid.
Yeah. And
yep.
You know, as the book says, you're not supposed to repeat an allegation. It's the oldest rule, one of the oldest rules in politics. If, you know, the Nixon, I am not a crook. All people will remember is, you know, you don't repeat the allegation. And Trudeau had been told that and learned that as well. But I think I love this. It was kids that actually persuaded him that the I'm not ready charge or he's not ready had penetrated to every level.
Right.
One of his friend's nannies said that when Trudeau's name was mentioned around their house, the kids were saying nice hair. You know, so if the ad had got to kids, then there was only one way to do it, and it was to walk straight into it, too.
Mm.
I thought it was, you know, it was one of those things you sort of know instinctively, but then the ad guys said that they did. It was very deliberate that they put Trudeau moving in every ad.
Yes.
As opposed to, they wanted to show him doing things that Tom Mulcair and Stephen Harper would not do.
Right, right.
Climbing Grouse Mountain, walking upstairs on
sure.
an escalator. They
not the shot behind a static desk with the lamp at night kind of approach.
Right. And a friend of mine told me that the Mulcair ads looked like those insurance, those ads you get from, you know, lawyers who will deal with your car crash.
Right, right.
Yeah, that's, yeah, there were no, the pattern was set really early.
Sure.
The day of the election. Actually, you could distill the first day of the election into how the election was going to turn out, because Harper and Mulcair stayed in Ottawa, put themselves against the backdrop of big, gray, immovable buildings, and talked about Ottawa things. And everybody said that Trudeau was an idiot for getting on a plane. He's just not ready.
Right.
Got on a plane, went all the way across the country to Vancouver, and a few hours later, turns up, sunny skies behind him, a bunch of people, and the contrast between that kind of politics and was there day one, right?
Didn't he humanize it to some degree, Susan?
What's that?
Didn't he humanize it to some degree?
And he showed that that the election wasn't going to be won by who was the angriest person in Ottawa.
Yeah, I'm a real guy. I actually do want to shake your hand. I do care about the issues. The images might be saying this, but I've also, and this is kind of taking the tools, I think, and using them wisely and appropriately, but I'm also on the ground over here. You know,
this isn't in the book, but I saw him at the end of June last year when things were looking really, really bad. So this is about a year ago now, and everybody was saying that Tom Mulcair was going to be the next minister, and the Liberals' polls were showing them that way, too. It was bad last summer, and the Not Ready ads had worked, and I ran into him he actually gave a speech on Canada-U.S. relations at the Chateau Laurier.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, are you worried at all? Are you upset? Are you seeing these? And he said, no. He said, you've been on the road out there with me. You see what's happening. And he knew, unlike his predecessor, Michael Ignatieff, who seemed to be caught flat-footed when Jack Layton said, why haven't you been in Ottawa?
Right.
Trudeau was very unapologetically not in Ottawa. As Liberal leader,
right,
he had he spent as little time here as possible, and the campaign showed that.
Do you think that Trudeau, Prime Minister Trudeau, treated Canadians with a little more respect, from an ad campaign perspective? Does that make sense?
Like
treated them more as opposed to just the Tim Hortons, you know, like the Tim Horton Canadian.
I think their advertising fundamentally spoke to a different thing. I think the NDP got close to that too.
Right.
Especially in the campaign before, Jack Layton definitely did. A lot of the Liberals' ideas came from both places too. You know, they didn't just dream these up, and I think they did want to channel some of Jack Layton's spirit too. The guy you want to have beer with, the guy who says Ottawa is broken, the guy who seems to have a smile on his face all the time. That was definitely, you know, it helped that they had a guy who could do that. That Trudeau is, I think, fundamentally an optimistic person. He reminds a lot of people, for good and for ill, of his father.
Right. Yep.
So I think they had, if you want to use marketing language, they had a credible salesman.
Right.
I think they were convinced all the way through, and this was very much Trudeau, that you could speak to people optimistically.
And don't we all want to believe that there is a leader out there that we can trust who is going to be transparent, who is going to lead us in the right way?
Well, not if you stay here in Ottawa.
but you get the medal, though.
Yeah. It's very important for us to get out of here every now and then.
Right.
I was really glad that I, in retrospect, that my that I got a chance to spend some time out in the world with Trudeau a couple of years before the election, because you did see something was going on out there that I don't think people here in Ottawa understood. The Conservatives were fond of saying that Trudeau was the media darling.
Right.
Unless there are different reporters in Ottawa than the ones I know, there wasn't a whole lot of... The Ottawa Press Gallery collectively is a pretty cynical pack.
I bet.
And I didn't detect a lot of affection for Trudeau.
Hmm, interesting.
Before the election. And still, you know, you get the... I think he's got some grudging respect now.
Right.
But it certainly... When he landed here, I don't think he was taken seriously by the usual pundit and chattering classes. And I think you had to go out there on the road with him to see what was going on. The story, again, I'm not sure whether this is in the book, but I tell it often, is I was in Winnipeg on a Friday night in February, and it was 40 degrees below zero. And a friend there told me that she was going off to a Trudeau event at 10 o'clock at night on a Friday night. And she said, if you're doing this book, you should go and see it. And I said, who is going to show up on a Friday night at 10 o'clock in 40 below weather?
Right.
And we drove 20 minutes outside of the center of Winnipeg to a suburb there. And there were 400 people waiting to see him.
Wow.
And that was 2 years before the election.
Wow.
So something was going on.
Something was going on.
And it wasn't just marketing. And it wasn't just imagery. And it certainly wasn't the recommendations of the political class in Ottawa.
So after all these years, the political writing, the journalism, the interviews, the traveling, I mean, are you currently hopeful? I mean, I think I can hear that tone in your voice.
Yep, I am.
Yeah.
I am.
Tell me more about that.
I think a lot of my hope was restored during the NECAB debate.
Huh.
For a while there, it felt like a very bleak time here. And I say this without partisan... With no partisan bent or anything like that. Although, as a journalist, I think, you know, we had to object to a lot of things that were going on with the Conservatives when they were in.
Sure.
But I thought that was a really black time there. And if it had worked, if the dog whistle politics had worked during the election campaign, you know, regardless of which party was promoting them, I would have been in a pretty bleak mood.
Because of where this was potentially going to lead.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The shutting down of conversation, the inherent racism, et cetera.
Snitching on your neighbor.
Right.
That's the opposite of politics, right? That's a bit distressing. And the fact that it didn't work, and the fact that 3 million more people voted in this campaign than voted the last time, tells me that all our work here is not in vain. You know, sometimes you think that nobody's listening. And I take it, you know, media companies don't share their numbers or something like that, but the media company, the numbers or figures I heard during the campaign was that a lot of people were paying attention to the election. And I went to Toronto, which admittedly is not representative of all of Canada, but in the middle of August, I went to Toronto and stood on a street corner with a candidate, NDP candidate, actually. And I was surprised by how many people coming out of the subway knew that an election was on. We're always shocked and grateful now that anybody knows what's going on.
Yeah, it's true.
But it seemed to count to people, right? This last election, and I think even now the Conservatives, you saw the jokes, I guess, from the Press Gallery dinner over the weekend.
Yes, yes.
Realized that something went a little off the rails in the last few years.
Yes,
and,
yes.
And it's time to get it back. I don't think Stephen Harper was a bad man, as Rose said.
Yes, right.
But I think things got a little too cynical here.
Do you think that if politicians treated, you know, Canadians, I'm not going to, you know, forget about Tim Hortons for a second, but just Canadians, period, a little more intelligently, with a little more, just talked about, and I think Trudeau did this, but just talk to us a little bit more as fellow Canadians respectfully, in a more transparent way, in a more truthful way. I mean, a lot of people said that he was wrong to apologize for the, you know, Elbowgate incident, which I think is would be a lovely and interesting conversation to have with you at another time. But just that level of, I don't know, humanity, honesty. I mean, I think that's what most people want. And I think this election sort of...
I do too. And, you know, if you had asked me about 3 weeks ago, I would have been a little more worried about them, frankly, these guys, because they were starting to do a few of the things, and Trudeau has now since said it, that rushing things through the House, ignoring the opposition, and then, you know, the elbow was just sort of the tip of the iceberg there. And I was one of the people... saying on Twitter, he better apologize, and he better make it a real apology, not one of those if anyone was offended ones.
Right.
And I think there seems to be some evidence that he or his advisors or all of them had a little chat with themselves and decided this isn't our best selves.
Right.
That's let's do this again. My husband wrote a column about this in National News Watch last weekend, and the response to that column has shown me that it got a huge readership, and I think it was because people, he said that it was interesting and laudable that somebody was actually backing down from things, and I think Canadians understand that too.
Hmm.
You know, I think something has happened here in the past few weeks that convinces me that these guys haven't forgotten that they were elected to be different.
Right. Yeah, I guess obviously time will tell and how things unfold over the next few years. But I'm hopeful too. I think there's lots of ripples still to come.
They're
hope.
Still calling press releases product, so I don't.
Oh man! Kinda, yeah. So back to that whole, you know, we'll wrap things up here in a couple minutes. But back to that whole consumeristic kind of thing. That to me, it's really dehumanizing, right? I mean, I'm not a consumer. I'm a human being, for heaven's sakes. I've got feelings. I do access. But from a marketing perspective, I guess it makes a whole lot of sense.
Well, I think if we can remember that we are sometimes consumers and sometimes we don't want... Sometimes we want to actually pay more for things.
Right.
You know? That's, sometimes we don't care about the cost because something else is more important to us. And I think that's... you know, I don't spend my days shopping. And
right.
I don't spend my
yeah.
days looking at every one of my decisions through the prism of what is the best shopping
well,
experience.
Well, no need to invoke Marx, but I'm not a commodity.
Exactly, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And don't treat me that way.
That's right, yeah.
My son and I and my daughter, Victoria and Spencer, you know, from time to time, we'll watch ads. They'll come on and, you know, oh, wow, I really love this ad. But there was a time when it was kind of with them, even a couple of years ago, hey, can you spot the lie? Where's the lie in the advertisement?
Oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah, and it's pretty interesting. And I don't know that it's had a huge impact on them. I think time will tell. But it is interesting to see that I think my kids are fairly attentive viewers.
Yeah.
And I think I've always maintained I don't care so much about what's on the tube or what's being offered. I care more about the analysis, more about the, you know, being able to say, no, I don't want to see that movie, or that is a lie, or don't. You know, this shampoo is not going to make me, know, a better catch.
Yeah. Well, you saw that when really sort of the consumerist revolution hit with the in the 1950s and 60s, that people even then were suspicious of ads, and you saw Chatelaine warning people, you can be an educated consumer.
Right.
And I think, you know, people are rewarded for that.
Well, and let's hope that continues, you know, politically as well. I mean, let's hope that there is sort of a new light that's been shone, and not only in this whole sort of consumeristic approach to marketing and to politics, but maybe that's the observation or the insight for me, is that maybe the tools can be used in a more positive and a hopeful way.
Use their powers for good, not evil.
That's right. Yeah, see, well, you got to quote Spider-Man, you know, when you can. With great power comes great responsibility, it seems to me. Susan, thanks so much for your time today.
Oh, thanks. This was great fun.
Susan Delacorte, she's a political columnist with the Toronto Star and iPolitics, and she's been covering a place, Canada's capital, since the 80s that apparently you've got to get away from time to time. And my family and I are going there this summer. So are you telling me we should go hang out at the Metropolitan? Is that
exactly? You never know who will walk by.
Yeah, no, it sounds fun. The book is Shopping for Votes, How Politicians Choose Us and How We Choose Them. Susan Delacorte, thanks so much for being a guest today on Face to Face.
Thanks, David.